In the world of developing people, we've done a really bad job at collecting and analyzing primary data. We've gone and built beautiful dashboards and beautiful outputs without actually fixing the input.
90% of managers say they're miserable when it comes to their performance management system. Our guest today describes himself as a personal patient of the pain, and he's on a mission to revolutionize performance management systems by combining AI and humans and focusing each on what they do best. Welcome to the Learn It All podcast, the show for today's leaders who want to get ahead and stay ahead, because we know that great leaders aren't born or made, they're constantly in the making. I'm your host, Damon Lemby. I'm a two-time best-selling author, and I'm the CEO of Learn It, a live learning platform that has helped upskill over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. Joining me today, I'm excited to welcome JJ Katek. JJ is the founder and CEO of OnLoop, a Gen AI company focusing on making every manager a great manager. And in our conversation, we really dig into why continuous feedback fosters team growth and better results, why high performers crave constructive feedback just as much as those who are struggling, and how real-time feedback aligns individuals and organizational goals. And I think we have a really fascinating conversation around the future of AI and knowledge work and how it's going to reshape the future. I was looking at the research and it says up to 90% of managers are unhappy with traditional performance management systems. So obviously it's broken. So what is it about these traditional management systems that is broken?
Yeah, you're literally right. This morning before I came onto this podcast, I was listening to a Naval Ravikant, Balaji Srinivasan interview, and they were talking about what technology was able to do in the last sort of 30 or 40 years is take away physical drudgery, right? So dishwashers, washing machines, cars, like things that sort of helped you with sort of taking drudgery away from the physical world. I think in the process at work, we've created a lot of intellectual drudgery. So report writing, form filling, email writing, essay writing. And I would say writing performance reviews is probably one of the most palpable, globally sort of prevalent versions of that intellectual drudgery. And I think not only is it intellectual drudgery, it also leads to really poor results and outcomes. So my sort of founding moment was back in 2018, I was asked by Uber to go run our Philippines business. And I inherited a 50-person team. I had to do calibrations and sort of ratings in about 2 weeks. And for those 2 weeks, all that people did was sit and write reviews. But when we went into the calibration room, we still made up stuff from memory because none of that data was actually skimmable or usable for decision-making. So not only was it highly time-consuming, but it was also ineffective and also biased. And which is why, like, I don't believe performance management as a category of software works. In the same way that taxi as a category did not work until Uber came around and sort of brought technology into how people move from point A to point B. And so performance management and also OKRs have been a terrible implementation of goals and feedback. And what we set out to do is, can we do goals and feedback in a way that people don't hate it? Because goals and feedback are really sort of the underlying pillars of high performance businesses and are really part of the business operating system, but they've sort of been co-opted by form-filling processes that have led to people hating them.
Yeah. So let's stay there for a second. Why are goals and feedback so critical?
Because ultimately, you know, and we actually sort of put that into our own proprietary framework that we call collaborative team development. Because you know, often we talk about the job of a manager and it's sort of seen as this woo-woo sort of, you know, dark arts thing about, oh, like good managers are great, but like everybody's had a bad manager and nobody quite knows why. And so we're like, can we sort of really productionize this and break this down? So we broke it down into 5 layers. And the base layer is around energy and motivation, right? So if someone's not motivated to perform for whatever reason, right? It might be going through a health crisis or something, maybe going at home or it's conflict at work, but energy and motivation really sits at the bottom of the base layer of performance. And I don't like the word well-being for that angle because well-being sort of makes it sort of not associated with performance, but we really think energy and motivation sits at the base of it. And the next layer above that is goals. And we define goals as targets, projects, and skills. And sort of driving ultimate clarity around what each individual is trying to do. Because if you don't have clarity around what you're trying to do, and that may not always be a number, right? So certain jobs cannot be easily quantified, but it can be quantified either into a target, project, or skill. And if you can stack rank that well and prioritize it, your likeliness to succeed massively increases. And we tell managers that if your people are motivated and they know exactly what they need to do a good job, that is 60% of the battle won. And then the remaining 40% is what we call the sustaining performance layers, which is two layers of feedback. So celebrate feedback, not just to recognize people, but to really help them understand what their superpowers are. And then finally, the top two layers are usually where you need to help high performers. So you need to give high performers constructive feedback to help them understand how they can be better. And then ultimately learning and growing on a continuous basis based on sort of skill goals or feedback that you're receiving. And actually, the biggest mistake we see managers make is when they have a low performer, they immediately jump to improve feedback. So they tell them all the things that they could be doing better without actually investigating what's happening at the more core layers of performance, which is energy and goals. And when they're a high performer, they sort of give them no constructive feedback. Because they're like, oh, you're doing a great job. Like, keep doing what they're doing. But what they're actually craving is constructive feedback to get better over time. And you can actually abstract that out to an organization as well. So we think about this as a model for individual productivity. But if an organization is not energized, and we all know of organizations that kind of go stale, right? Like people talk about HP and companies that, you know, used to be big in the 50s and 60s, and GE, another example that sort of, you know, just became slow and sluggish. And then if your strategic priorities are not clear, or you don't know when to take big technology leaps, you also kind of die. And so we sort of apply the model to individual productivity, but often we've seen organizations sort of scaling that to how do we think about organizational productivity too. I think team dynamics is a different topic, and we can go into it, which has a separate set of factors to it. But you know, when I was at Stanford Business School doing my MBA, we spent 2 years effectively learning feedback. And a lot of people consider Stanford to be the world's best business school. And sort of the emphasis on self-awareness and feedback was a cornerstone of the program. But when I came back to the workplace, and we had to deal with Workday and Reflective and massive form filling exercises at Uber, I was like, look, like these are HRIS systems that do the job of having a database and running integrations. They're not meant to really inspire sort of regular growth from businesses. And so there has to be sort of a decoupling on how we think about sort of core HR systems, which I call systems of record, and then sort of systems of action that drive day-to-day behavior. And so, and frankly, I didn't know much about the industry per se. I was a personal patient of the pain.
No, I like that. And I've got so many questions, but going back to goals for a second. So we talk about individual personal goals. I've had other people on the show talk about also the importance of not only knowing your own personal goals, but also goals of other team members, right? And having transparency into that, because if you don't have transparency to that, sometimes you're not all aligned in the same direction. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Totally. So actually, one of our customers, Seek Now, which is an insurtech company out in Louisville, Kentucky, came to us with two very well-defined problem statements. One was their individual contributors were actually feeling very disconnected from the business because they were going about their work, but they actually could not see how their work contributes to the bigger picture. And their leaders who wanted to drive big strategic initiatives did not have confidence that they were going to achieve those outcomes because they did not have visibility on other things happening in the company sort of, you know, filling up. And they really liked the approach of thinking about goals as targets, projects, and skills. I think they had OKRs at a company level. And actually, OKRs do work at a company level. They just don't trickle down and cascade very well unless you have like a super specialist who's gone and learned it, and then they teach it to the company for like 9 months, and then everybody...
JJ, I'm You can. You need somebody basically to have a full-time job to just manage project management.
And so the organizational cost of doing that is just ridiculous. And so what they now do is in their monthly management meetings, we've built them these really pretty sort of flow diagrams that sort of link sort of high-level goals to sort of team goals and individual goals. And when they have a leading priority, like I want to improve customer experience by 10%, if that actually does not have projects feeding it, it's not going to change. And if the projects feeding it are off track, that's also not going to get better. And so that's now got built into sort of their operating system to sort of think about goals very simply as targets, products, and skills, keep them regularly updated to the app. And we've kind of also separated the dashboarding layer with the input layer. So the input layer is largely mobile to make it very easy to do. And then sort of the dashboarding and the visualization is primarily desktop because that's just a better surface to do it on. And people then can see, right? Like this project I'm working on, actually this feeds into this really important company priority, and that's where it sits. And then if a bunch of streamlines coming into a big company priority is red, the business can very quickly decide to focus resources towards moving that faster. And you know, it's not rocket science, you know, but I think we thought about it purely from first principles. We were not bogged down by what other people had done before. And I think that's probably our largest innovation, is that we didn't try to copy paste past successes and try to sort of build a product off it. We were like, look, what is fundamentally at the essence of goals and feedback, and how can we make it really frictionless for teams? And actually, one of the other sort of things we did for a while, and we now feel sort of ready to change that, is that we did not treat HR as the customer. We treated the business as the customer. And that meant that as a small product team, we could ensure our entire roadmap was focused on building better sort of outcomes for the business versus our roadmap being hijacked by what integrations do you have and what access control measures do you have and where are your servers and do you have backup, which are things that HR and IT care about. And they're all really important. But if your entire roadmap as a small startup is hijacked by functional orgs, you just don't innovate to solve the problem. And we're now talking to a very large insurance company, and the first conversation was with all of HR and IT. And I literally said, look, I feel like I'm ready to go from being a toddler to sort of a young child. And so I'm happy to start sort of really starting the conversation with HR and IT. But I wasn't ready before that because I didn't think I had solved the problem for the business well enough to then think about how does this work within an organizational context. So this goes back to what we were talking about before we came on the show as well. I think that often entrepreneurs, when they sort of, you know, raise capital around venture capitalists, there's a habit of trying to recognize patterns and things that have done in the past that have worked. When you're trying to solve large, hard problems, you have to sort of ignore everything that's been done in the past. And that doesn't always sit well with people, frankly. And so I think we've had to do things in a bunch of contrarian ways to actually solve the problem, because it's not a new problem. It's been around for a very long time. And we had to ask ourselves, why is this not solved yet? And for me, that's a combination of technology. I think AI is beautiful and how applied AI can be used to make goals and feedback a lot simpler. And we started working with GPT-3 back in early 2021. So we've been building Gen AI native tech for about 3 or 4 years now. And then B, I think you got to think about it from first principles. And I don't think that's necessarily happened before.
Yeah. And so what you're saying, so if I'm hearing correctly, you started off with maybe the going out in a specific direction, but then you realize that, hey, I got to get HR involved and kind of hear what they're saying. Is that a shift that you made intentionally, or is that just through being curious and making a couple of mistakes that you realize, hey, I got to get these guys in IT and everybody else involved earlier in the process?
I think it's the size of organization you're working with. So we deliberately sort of tried to work with organizations sub 500. And actually the sweet spot is sort of 100 plus people to 500 people, where sort of the decision maker was often the COO or the founder CEO of the business. When you're talking to an organization that's 55,000 people,
a lot,
the decision maker is not going to be the CEO of the business. It's going to be the CHRO of the business or the head of performance or rewards. But I did not want to go quote unquote enterprise first because I felt like that would hijack my roadmap in the wrong direction. So I think there's a term in software about going up market and sort of when do you go up market? And sort of my strategy was we would go up market as soon as we felt we had solved a core customer problem really well. And I've only started seeing data to validate that in the last 3 to 6 months.
And what problem is that you've solved really well that you're seeing?
Really increasing the quality and frequency of feedback in the organization on a 360 basis, which is collecting regular observations on your manager, your direct reports, your peers, as well as very high goals coverage in terms of every individual in the org having true clarity on what they're working on, and then aligning that to organizational goals.
You know, speaking about true clarity, I just had the privilege to interview Doug Conant, who is the CEO of Campbell's, who did a massive turnaround, 25,000 person company. And he just kept emphasizing the importance, especially in 21st century leadership, how important it is to be crystal clear, both from your own and intentional, both from your own perspective, but for your organization. Because JJ, if you're not, then guess what? Everybody, the anxiety goes up. People are frustrated because they don't know what they're supposed to do, right?
Yeah, and actually that clarity is not that hard to do in the C-suite. I mean, what is really hard is how do you translate that clarity down to every part of the organization. And I think most organizations have a fairly clearly articulated goals at a corporate level, right? So be it Campbell's or even our customers, when we start working with them, they do have organizational goals. But what they've historically struggled with is how does this translate down? And how do we then use these goals to give everybody clarity? And usually with financial targets, they travel quite well. Like if you have a $5 million revenue target, it's quite easy to chop that up into pieces and have that slow down. But if you have a big strategic shift, right, like, you know, implement Gen AI in the organization, let's call it, which a lot of large corporates are thinking about, unless that accurately and effectively sort of breaks down into smaller pieces that other people are doing, you're not going to achieve that top level strategic priority. And that's where we see it often falls apart.
And also, you know, you talk about the foundation of your five pillars, motivation and energy. You know, we have 6 or 7 generations in the workforce these days, and especially everybody, but especially the younger generations, they want it to be more than just financial, right? They want to be able to tie their goals and motivation to also purpose.
Yeah. No, and actually, I was coaching a CEO yesterday. And one of his employees has been saying that he's not been feeling that excited lately. And actually, you know, he hadn't realized this till we spoke, that this person was a very high performer who was also the only fully remote member on the team. And so everybody else was based out in sort of Bangkok, but this person lives in sort of a village sort of 5 hours away from Bangkok, is never able to spend time with the team. And actually, purpose and meaning is very hard to translate and feel with digital technology today, which is why I'm incredibly excited about immersive VR as another turbine of the future of work to sort of make people feel like they're in the same place, even if they aren't. But Google did some research on what makes a high-performing team. And this was research was done maybe about 10 or 12 years ago. And you might have heard of it because that's when psychological safety really became a household term. So this was the Google research in which they said psychological safety of everything else is the most important. But the four other pillars are dependability, structure and clarity, purpose and meaning as the five things that teams really need to feel as a group. And what I've seen is there are CEOs who are better at the structure and clarity and dependability piece. And there are CEOs who are better at the purpose and mission piece. Very rarely does both those pieces exist in the same leader. And actually the CEO that I coach is much more dependability and structure and clarity person. I'm much more of a purpose and mission person. It was interesting for us to have that conversation. But I think to your point, it's not one size fit all. And I don't think we can just apply the same thing. And that's why when we spend time with managers, we often sort of teach them on how to ask the right questions to understand what's happening around that energy and motivation layer. And the reality is that what is most important is awareness of what's going on. Like if someone's spouse is going through a health crisis, you can't do much about it, right? Like, but if someone's not feeling a sense of purpose with the work, you can do something about it. And so, you know, I think being intentional and being aware sound, you know, they don't sound like ROI and dollars, but often some of the most important currencies of actually building great businesses. And that's been the arc of my career is, how do we really think about people, but from the core lens of driving business outcomes? And unfortunately, I don't see people marry the two very well.
Well, they need to. And here's why, because I mean, technology, I mean, I'm out here in San Francisco. We talked about that, right? It's a hotspot epicenter for AI and everything. But at the end of the day, you need people are what are going to make your business scale, evolve. And so you need the two. So I think that's critical. What are some specific examples of questions that you think leaders can be asking their team to help bring that out and make their employees feel more heard?
Yeah. So you know, there's also been a lot of research around vulnerability and sort of what vulnerability brings into the workplace. And you know, our number one core value is trust. And the reality is that if people don't feel trusted or they don't trust you, I think the chances of opening up is much harder. And if people don't open up, you don't ever sort of get down to sort of what's really going on. And so one of the things we often talk to managers about is that if you just go through a shared experience together or you share something going on in your own life, that often drives the other side to also share. And then when someone says, hey, how are you doing? And they say, fine, you know, you probe, right? You just don't take, like often managers will be like, oh, I asked my team member how they're doing. They said, fine. I'm like, well, but did you
look, and then move on.
Yeah. Did you actually get down to really what's going on? So I think even before it goes into asking questions, it's really establishing that trust. And often that trust gets established by sort of being vulnerable yourself. And then that then makes the other side sort of open up. But I think in many ways, driving performance is making people feel understood. And that's really the human side of being a manager.
And so I love what we talked about before was also that, you know, Onlope is a technology company, but you're really merging in some of the professional services that go along with it. But in talking about Onlope, so how does Onlope help with what we're talking about here? How do we help employees feel more heard and be able to get continuous feedback and learn and grow?
So, you know, we have an oversized focus on every manager in the organization. So if you go to our website, it says making every manager a great manager. Because we feel that when you do things at an every individual level, it can become almost too much. And if you do things just at a leadership level, it can almost become too little. And so we think about people managers as the most important sort of group in the organization. And then we sort of, in the first quarter of working with a business, we'll sort of run a parallel track where we'll onboard everybody on the platform. And we do very typical sort of, you know, leadership onboarding, manager onboarding, team onboarding around how the tool works and how the tool operates. But in parallel, we will train every manager in the organization through a four-hour workshop around sort of the five layers of CDD and to really sort of help discuss and understand the core challenges around each of those five layers. And what that does is that it energizes the organization to adopt a new approach to going about their business day to day, because frankly, nobody likes a new tool thrown at them. And there is a ton of tool fatigue in organizations, and nobody wants another tool unless they understand that that tool is going to facilitate an approach every day that's actually going to make their lives easier. And so we sort of go in and implement a tool, but we also go teach an approach. And then we sort of round that out at the end of the first quarter with our sort of AI-generated performance reviews that we call Prisms, that take sort of the ongoing observations and then stitch that together, either structured by values or structured by our own categories, or now we can do that in any custom format that an organization wants. And we sort of show how transformational it is if your organization has goals and feedback clarity without spending days in drudgery of reports. And then it sort of kind of takes off after that on its own. But I think the initial quarter of working with a business is super important to drive the right impact, and which is why we don't shy away from doing the human work as well of making that impact.
Well, that's so important because, there's just an abundance of tools and change fatigue and change in general, people are just get frustrated with. And so I look at it, thinking about it, you're talking about middle managers, people managers. And as I was kind of going through your website, one of the things that struck me, which I think is so key as far as helping them understand why this is important for them.
Yes.
Is that, people could spend their whole week writing performance reviews. And from what I could tell, OnLoop does is basically eliminates that and buys back all that time for everybody, right? So that's a great incentive to want to adopt your tool.
My t-shirt says you weren't born to write performance reviews.
Send me one.
I believe that 200%, because it's AI is very good at the stitch together output. What humans are very good at is observations and insights. And so through our approach, we shift all the human energy towards capturing unstructured observations and insights, either through voice or text. And then we use technology to parse that through, rewrite that feedback out using the right situation behavior impact framework, extracting skills and competencies from it so that people really understand sort of how day-to-day feedback should really work. And then when it comes time for more structured reviews, we then stitch all of that together as a cohesive output. That way, everybody in the company is using a similar language base. It's not then biased on which manager is more sort of, positive versus negative, extroverted versus introverted. And so we start trying to look at everybody in the organization through a similar lens of eloquence. I often talk about how eloquence bias is one of the biggest drivers of sort of gender parity or race.
And why is that?
Because frankly, usually the straight white extroverted male is the most likely to advocate for themselves and their team.
Interesting.
And people who advocate most for themselves and their team usually move ahead irrespective of actual performance. And typically, if you talk about global companies, Americans tend to be more sort of visible than, say, the Japanese in the same org. It doesn't mean that the Japanese person is doing less work necessarily or is less impactful. It just doesn't have sort of an extroverted focus on presence in the workplace. And so by using sort of AI to write reviews or use sort of similar language, you actually create a much more level playing field to make sure the work shines versus someone's ability to market themselves or their team shine. And I think that sits at the core of so many issues that we talk about in the workplace. But often people are out there busy solving systems. And, God bless DEI trainers, but I don't think DEI training will necessarily make the workplace more equitable. I think unless we look at the actual practices that make the workplace inequitable, that's not going to change.
And I think that also takes place in the interview process. And I think you have can you share a little bit about Interview Hero, right? Because you could use your tool for that as well, right?
Yeah. So we did a product hunt launch to use some of the same tech to take unstructured notes from an interview and then sort of convert that into structured insights, into strengths and blind spots. And then sort of, observations that sort of the AI is able to extract. Frankly, we haven't done a ton with the product, just because it's out there, people can find it and use it. But I think we're busy enough as a fairly small team on sort of making things work end to end around sort of driving day-to-day clarity. I'm really passionate about recruiting too, and I continue to believe that's another very large broken space.
I was just curious. I thought maybe it had something to do with helping drive decisions when it came into the interview process using unstructured data. But hey, maybe you'll get there. You'll get there at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've other ideas on how to really fix recruiting, but yes, continues to be a $400 billion broken industry.
Have you seen situations where there's a gap between, feedback is actually given in these reviews and actually how team performance happens?
So, one of the things we talk a lot about is, I think one of the issues with performance reviews being part of compliance in terms of where it comes from is that people are often very reticent to put real feedback in reviews because they see the review as part of company record, right? And so we think about the review and the development conversation cadence at every 3 or 6 months as sort of one set of outputs, and then weekly one-on-ones or bi-weekly one-on-ones as another sort of cadence and rhythm that gets built in organizations. And actually right now, we're having a conversation internally in the organization that when someone has an observation about a team member, some of it might be more relevant and maybe more appropriate for going into the weekly one-on-one versus going into the stream for a Prism summary. And team performance will ultimately boil down to essentially whether the team has the skills to go achieve the targets and the projects that they need to go achieve. And which is why we think about skills in the same importance as targets and projects as we think about goals. Often in companies, you have business goals and then personal development goals, and they sit separately, which we also think is super wrong because then people focus on the business goals, forget the personal development goals, and that becomes irrelevant. But often a team or a person may not be able to do their core job very well because there's an inherent skill gap. And if you don't close that skill gap, nothing else matters. Mm-hmm. And often an organization might take the call that they don't have the time or the ability to close that skill gap for a particular person and have to let them go or make team changes. But essentially what sort of regular feedback does and what we think is more important than the feedback is being able to extract the skills and competencies from it to then be able to very quickly sort of help each person understand what their superpowers and blind spots are, and then help organizations understand what their superpowers and blind spots are so that you can do something about those blind spots because or else it's very hard to actually drive change.
So in OnLoop, does it store or track like what people's, self-assessed skills are? Is it anywhere that says, like the people, like they could self-assess themselves on like, I'm good at critical thinking, or their managers can assess them that? Is that accumulated anywhere?
So it's a good point. So we actually don't think people should self-assess themselves on anything. They should make self-observations on themselves, right? So you can tell the OnLoop app around, look, for a big presentation, my boss came to me the night before, because we still hadn't answered a key client question, and I was able to creatively really look into what are possible new ways of solving it and really present a coherent argument. From that, we can deduce the person has critical thinking.
Okay, I like that.
But the problem is someone thinking their critical thinking has no correlation with the actually have critical thinking. And that's the reality. But you take a set of observations across various people, you can then extract what are people's superpowers and blind spots from it. And so where we shift everyone's attention to is observations. And unstructured observations around the people that you work with, because that is the real primary data, right? Everything else is then deduced from that primary data. And in the world of developing people, we've done a really bad job at collecting and analyzing primary data. We've gone and built beautiful dashboards and beautiful skill taxonomies and beautiful outputs without actually fixing the input. And which is why as a company, we've been so focused on fixing the input layer. Because if you have, and which is why applied AI is beautiful, because now it sort of allows you to look at a lot of unstructured data and sort of lend structure to it. But that unstructured data on someone being like, yeah, you know, like Michael comes into the meeting and is like, kind of lethargic, like it's clear he's not stupid, but like, you know, his energy is kind of low, and then people are kind of distracted, and like he should do something about it, like that's the kind of observation that people have, and we like, that's great, that's how humans are. Like, we don't memorize phone numbers anymore for a reason, because your address book is better at memorizing phone numbers, in the same way that like we should stop teaching people how to do feedback. Because it's an unnatural behavior. You need to show them, you need to take their observations and then show them. Actually, we've started seeing at a few customers that people are using lesser AI-enhanced reviews over time from an individual feedback perspective. And we try to understand why. It's because people are learning how to do good feedback, right? So like if you put parking sensors and parking cameras, people get better at parking because now you know how close you are to the curb. And so next time you don't have a parking camera in your car, you can probably park better versus if you never saw what good looked like. And so I think we've kind of gone about it a little bit backwards in how we've thought about equipping people with the right skills. And sort of our belief is don't try to make them do something unnatural. Meet them where they are and then use technology to then cross the hump.
I love that. I think that's awesome, because you can't help solve for blind spots and superpowers if you don't have a place to start at. Now, one of the things I heard you just say right there is you said, you know, stop teaching people how to provide feedback, right? Yeah. Is that what you're saying? Now, yeah. How about this? I mean, you studied this at Stanford for a couple of years. I also just interviewed another amazing guy, Craig Dowden, who wrote a great book called A Time to Lead. And what he said, research shows, JJ, is that really what people need to learn how to do is learn how to receive feedback. What are your thoughts about that?
100%. And actually, one of the best ways to create feedback culture in organizations is for leaders to request feedback. And Kim Scott talks about this too, and you know, I've had the privilege of meeting her, is that the best way to give more feedback is to ask for more feedback. Because once you ask for it, it sort of opens up the other side. The other thing that I talk a lot about, which is why I really dislike the culture of radical transparency, which companies like Netflix and Bridgewater has sort of popularized, is that yes, you can drive behavioral change through fear. Like I think it is a thing, and you know, I worked at Uber for 3.5 years. I loved the company, but it wasn't perfect, and you know, I think there were aspects of that there too. But lasting behavioral change does not happen through fear. It happens through inspiration. And when we do feedback training for companies, because we do feedback training too, we just tell them, but use the tool because it's easier. The first thing about giving feedback is asking for openness on the other side, which is why in our app, we allow people to share, celebrate feedback digitally, but we block them from sharing improved feedback digitally. We ask them to we ask them to jot it down and have it converted, but then deliver it to the next in-person conversation. And then share it once you've had the conversation. Because openness to feedback and whether someone's in a place to receive feedback is one of the most important determinators of how that person will act upon that feedback. Whether that will lead to defensiveness or apathy, or it will lead to change. And which is why we say that all feedback is direct and kind. And if you screamed at someone and they didn't change, that's on you. It's not on them. And usually we see senior leaders sort of, you know, jumble up their emotions with the feedback. But there is no room for emotion in feedback.
You mentioned, you know, you want to, as a leader, you want to find times when people are open to receiving feedback. Do you have any advice for leaders out there? I mean, obviously it starts with self-awareness, but what's some ways that a leader can determine or hopefully get right when somebody would be more open to receiving feedback between when they would not be?
It's easy. You have to ask. We're not mind readers. But if you're going to give someone some constructive feedback, I think the most important thing is to ask, hey, I had some constructive feedback for you. Is now a good time? And sort of just asking for that permission immediately on the other side creates openness. And person might say, actually, you know what? I'm just rushing a deadline. Can we talk about this tomorrow?
And if somebody says they're not open, you got to be okay with that, right? I mean, you can't just push forward anyways. And also, I don't think you should ever give constructive feedback in a group in front of people either, right? You know, I mean,
you know, celebrate publicly, shame privately.
Yeah. Or not even shame, even if it's just constructive, right? You just be, you know, people, nobody wants to be called out in front of their team.
No, I mean, I think it's interesting. The times when I will do it and I will explicitly say this is because I think this is something that is relevant to everybody, right? So if someone did a piece of analysis that did not say tied back to a customer insight, I'm making up a scenario, right? Mm-hmm. And you're delivering that feedback as to why that didn't hit the mark, that is often helpful to share because it's a way of doing things at a company that is more effective. And usually in that case, I will use people who I have a deeper trusted relationship with. So like my designer, Michael, who I've worked with for 4 years and know inside out, like I will often use him as that example because I know that there is underlying trust that exists and it's not going to lead to a lack of psychological safety. But if someone has just joined the company, you probably don't want to do that.
Yeah, so you got to know your situation.
Correct. So it depends on how much trust is established in the org. And Netflix and Bridgewater would argue that they're very high trust environment, but I don't think they are.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say about all this is, you know, what's so great about your tool is that people want to receive feedback, and the fact that you're making it now, so it's not like the freaking Olympics happen once every 4 years. It's a continuous on loop. You're removing the barriers to make it easier for people to receive feedback more and more and more, which I believe will help drive growth and trust in companies. So let me ask you this as we kind of wrap it up here. What do you believe is the biggest long-term impact that this approach and what you're doing with OnLoop can have for the world?
So our company vision is, how do you unlock the full potential of 1 billion knowledge workers? And so that's the sort of big, hairy, lofty goal. But you know, when I left Uber, I wrote down about 16 or 17 problem statements that I tied together in this category that I call talent tech versus HR tech, on all of the ways that technology was not helping talent and organizations grow because we were designing tools for functional use cases like HR. And especially in knowledge work, where the quality of someone's work can be hard to determine because it's not all metricized, I think really understanding sort of behavioral superpowers of people and sort of the impact that they make allows, you know, the highest performing people to advocate for themselves, both internally and in new roles, and really sort of help each person get better. And I think the world is a little too sort of dominated by people like me, who are loud, extroverted, speak their mind, are assertive, and women, minorities, introverts, people who struggle to find their voice often get left behind. And I'd like to see a world where that's a whole lot fairer.
That's great. I love it. Give me one more thing. What's one thing we didn't talk about that you want to share with our listeners?
I think that, you know, AI is changing things a lot. And I think this is the most seismic shift to knowledge work ever seen. And this is really the industrial revolution for knowledge workers. And so I think the impact's going to be huge. And I think what I would like every person, including young people, to be is sort of positively paranoid about how do you truly differentiate yourself, and not just do something because somebody else told you to do. And you know, I'm lucky that my energy comes from making decisions, inspiring other people, and kicking off work streams that haven't started yet, which I think AI will take a while to get to. And so I feel decently about my competitive advantage, but even I was paranoid when it first came out, being like, is it going to take my job? And I think everybody should be positively paranoid about what aspects of our job will AI take, and what aspects of our job AI will not take. And therefore, how can we get better at things? And I think, you know, emotion work and emotional skills will become the new hard skills, and because all of the hard skills will be done better by machines. So you're better off learning to be a great conversationalist and to be a software developer. And so I think that will sort of turn on its head in terms of what skills are really valued. And we've built a generation of people on cognitive ability. I would question that.
And why is that?
I think machines will do the cognition work a lot better than most humans will.
Exactly, exactly.
But if I'm trying to like pitch my company, I don't think the guy at KKR wants to hear a robot pitch, even though the robot might do a better pitch. But ultimately, you know, BD deals around sort of partnerships or sales or funding is done on trust. And I think that will be hard to replicate with AI.
Yeah, I'm 100% there with you. I think if you have your head in the sand and you're going to avoid AI, you're nuts, you know, because you're just going to have to shift the way you work as at a personal level and as an organizational level. And I think there's so many great advantages, and we're really fortunate to have what we have. Anyways, JJ, I mean, this has been an awesome conversation. You know, we talked about your five pillars that you're working on. We did a deep dive into feedback and continuous feedback and how it permeates across the organization, and taking a different approach than the frustrations that people have with traditional performance management. And then we also touched on AI and how that's going to impact the workforce in the future. So I just want to say thank you. I had a great time getting to know you, getting to speak with you. I wish you the best luck at OnLoop and everything else you do. I think you got gonna have a great impact on the world and that 1 billion people. So for all our listeners out there, if you know somebody who's frustrated with doing middle management, you know, and writing those terrible performance reviews they have to do, what I think you should do, and especially if they have a little influence in the organization, take this episode and text it to them and just say, hey, check this out. And maybe look at the tool OnLoop. So do that. And then while you're at it, rate and review the Learn It All podcast. And until next time, everybody, stay curious and keep learning. JJ, have a great day out there in Singapore. And congratulations on your new 7-month-old kid, man. Good luck.
Thanks, David.